Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to introduce Dr. Per Esben Stoknes to the podcast. Per is a distinguished psychologist and economist and chair of the Centre for Green Growth at the Norwegian Business School. He's a pioneer in the field of climate change psychology, which he studied for 20 years. Per is the author of numerous books, including the acclaimed What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. He's also a serial entrepreneur and co-founder of the clean tech company GasPlus. So thank you very much, Per, for taking the time today to speak to the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thank you.
So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your work on the psychology around how we think about climate change and some of the other work you're doing as well. You were at the New York during the UN Climate Week.
Yeah, I was indeed. Mainly focused around the TED conference that was the TED Global conference that was held, and had a connection to the climate and the global commons issue.
Right. Now, how long have you been researching and thinking and observing how people respond to climate change?
I'd say like 20 years, approximately.
Right.
So, it's been kind of accelerating over the last, let's say, 8.
Right. So just very quickly, can you tell us a little bit about your background? Because I know you've got an unusual background. You bring different skills and expertise to bear.
I started my research like 20 years ago, looking into long-term strategy for corporations and governments, and then progressed from there into understanding economics more deeply, because I was amused and curious and confused about how economists were choosing to understand the world. So I took a PhD in economics that became also quite interdisciplinary, including sociology and the history of economic discourse. Over the last 8 years, I've been focusing on climate strategies at Norwegian Business School, and also wrote this book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming.
Yes, absolutely. And so what's going on? I mean, I guess, how would you say that the thinking has changed broadly? I know different countries, it's more extreme and so forth. But just get a sense of how people thinking about climate change has been changing, or is some things remain unchanged?
It's kind of useful to distinguish between four main climate attitudes, or four dimensions in your climate attitude. And the first is, do we see global warming? Yes or no? The other is it human caused? Yes or no? The third is something to be concerned about, meaning is it bad? Yes or no? And the fourth is, are we going to solve it? Are humanity going to be able to keep temperatures below 2 degrees by 2100, to put it more precisely? Yes or no? What's your attitude? And when it comes to the first, is there global warming going on? We're kind of winning the debate. It's a clear majority of most people in most nations. On the second, it's a little bit worse. Is it human caused? But still, more than 50% in most Western countries say it is human caused. And then the most paradoxical is maybe the third, when it comes to is it bad? Is it something we should be concerned about? And there it's less than 50% who say it's clearly it's a high level concern. And the weird thing is that from 1990, approximately, when the survey started in some countries, it was higher than today. It was about like 7 out of 10 or 70% who said either very or somewhat concerned about greenhouse effect and climate change. And then as we've had more and more IPCC reports and 30,000 approximately climate science studies published and lots and lots of media articles, the population in rich Western countries in particular have become less concerned over time. That's what I call the psychological climate paradox. The paradox that the more certain the science, the less engaged and concerned the general public becomes. And it is a phenomenon peculiar to rich Western countries in particular. And the correlation is even strongest among English-speaking countries.
Really? Right, right.
Like Australia, US, Canada, and UK.
Right, right. So what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on? Exactly. That was my question too. So I scratched my head and started reviewing studies. So I dug up something like 300 to 400 studies from peer-reviewed from psychology, social anthropology, sociology, neurosciences. It seems that research is kind of converging on a consensus. So we have a social science consensus on climate communication in addition to the climate science consensus on the when it comes to the climate system itself. And in my book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, I try to give a very clear synopsis or a summary of these 300 studies. So I condensed the findings down to about five main inner defenses that are activated in climate in people when they hear news and fact about the climate coming straight at them.
Yes.
And if you will, I could give a short resume or...
Why don't you do that? Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Just, yeah, the headlines.
The headlines, and then we can delve in wherever you want. The first is distance or psychological distancing, meaning that the general public perceives the climate issue as being distant in several dimensions. First, distant in space. Media and news and also scientists have been speaking a lot about Arctic ice, polar bears, also cyclones in the Pacific or Caribbean. And to most people, that's far away from where they live. Also, the year 2050 and the year 2100 pops up all the time, and that makes it feel distant in time, because we humans are usually busy thinking about our next few weeks, not the next few centuries, put it that way. Third is it feels distant in terms of who is suffering or getting the impacts, because these are general poor people that I don't know far away from me. Richer people don't feel the impacts as clearly. It's also distant when it comes to responsibility. We hear about these COPs, the Conference of the Parties, the international negotiations where government heads and corporate executives and negotiators keep meeting. But I can't do anything to influence these people. It feels outside my circle of influence as an individual, so it feels far away from me. So in this sense, climate appears to be distant, psychologically distant in time, space, impacts, and responsibility. So that's the first defense. And there are a number of studies that have, like with surveys and focus groups and depth interviews, asked people what this does to them. And many report a feeling of helplessness and also a kind of a need to focus on nearer things. So the second defense then is doom, and that has to do with the framing of science. So when climate scientists have been publishing their model runs, it's often framed in the climate as the end is nigh, and these are incredible destructive forces, and catastrophe and disaster has been used as a framing more than 80% of the news articles out there. The third barrier or defense inside is called dissonance. And this has to do with how people feel when they, on the one hand, know what they should do. We have new knowledge about the climate situation. On the other hand, we continue to behave as if we didn't know much. So when there's this conflict between what we do and what we know, this is felt as an inner discomfort. We may feel like hypocrites. I care about the climate, and yet here I go filling my gas guzzler up again. And then people's brains come up with all kind of justifications to avoid that discomfort that the dissonance implies. And that is like, I could say my neighbor, for instance, he has a bigger car than I do, or my colleague, she flies even more than I fly, or changing my diet doesn't amount to much if I'm the only one doing so. Or I would also maybe want to doubt the climate science itself. I could say, well, climate is always changing. And thereby having an immediate psychological benefit of getting released from my painful dissonance. So that's why misinformation sometimes is very attractive to people, because it lets them off the hook, so to speak. They don't have to worry or don't have to feel bad about their lifestyles. The fourth defense is denial, which has been used a lot out there in the debate, often used as a pejorative about other people who are stupid, ignorant, or don't get it. It's really a much broader psychological phenomenon than that. It's about how people are able to live with troubling knowledge as if they don't know it. So denial, psychologically speaking, refers to a state of mind where I'm maybe aware of the troubling knowledge at some level in my brain, but I live and act as if I don't. So it's a double life, so to speak. And this double life may keep me safe from fear and guilt, but only if my family or community agrees that this is an issue we shouldn't speak too much about, or if we do, it's better to ridicule it. So in this way, there's a social contract not to raise that troubling knowledge, both inside myself and in others. So we avoid that topic at dinners, to put it that simply. This psychological denial is very common. All cultures or societies have issues about which they agree not to speak. And for subcultures and a lot of people in Western rich democracies, we have this level of cultural denial as well.
Right.
And finally, it's the fifth barrier. After distance, doom, dissonance, and denial comes identity. And the identity barrier has to do with your personal values, your outlook to the world, and how you see yourself in society, and what's your position on the balance between the market and government, for instance. And what we find is that people whose identity is identified with individualism, free market, freedom for the individual, and the government is then seen as something taking your freedom away, then there's a tendency clearly to want to distance themselves from climate science. And that comes across because if climate scientists come along saying what we need is more regulation and more carbon taxes, that is a bigger government, then I would probably have less trust in that kind of science, because I don't like the recommendations coming out of it and they go counter to my values. And we know from psychology very well that if there's a conflict between the values and and the facts, then the facts lose, and I will spend my intellect and knowledge coming up with all kinds of reinterpretation of the facts so that they match my values after all.
Right. Wow, that's a pretty wide-ranging, interlocking series of barriers. Now, I guess, we're not always rational, are we? Are these barriers any different from any other kinds of challenges that we face generally?
Yeah, I would say so. There are characteristics of the climate problems we have that are, so to speak, tailor-made to avoid our evolutionary and social setup as a species. So, for instance, fear and flight are, you know, very strong evolutionary powers in our limbic brain. But the problem with the climate is that it doesn't have, like, so we say, it doesn't have a clear enemy. So imagine if there was one country in the world who emitted all the 40 gigatons, and this country was run by a tyrant or some kind of maniac with a black mustache. Just imagine how long time it would take before countries united to bomb this guy out of existence. But unfortunately, climate doesn't have a clear enemy like that. It doesn't have either proximity, like a guy coming at you down the street with a big bat and a threatening hat. So it's kind of, when there is no enemy, the fear turns towards avoidance behavior. It's very different with terrorists, for instance, because you can focus your fear on them. So you get a strong us versus them attitude.
Right, right, right. Now, it's a very divisive issue, isn't it? It's very divisive. And clearly there are different parties communicating about this, and I guess you've got the people who are saying it's happening and it's terrible and we need to do something, and then, you know, broadly those that are saying no, it's not, and we don't need to do anything. Now, if formulated in such a simple way, but to what extent are these parties aware of what's going on, and to what degree are they managing their communication strategies around this insights into some of these issues you're talking about?
Well, some of the problem for the environmental movement and the climate movement and the climate scientists is that they've had this wrong assumption about climate communications. In the literature, it's often called the information deficit approach, which is that scientists and bureaucrats and activists in general have this unexamined assumption that if only people would get the information and the facts into their heads, then they would turn around and become into agreement with the scientific consensus.
Yes.
So the clue here is to just explain and get the information out, and then make it simpler, make it clearer, repeat it, get the facts out, do another study, do another report, and by the end, people certainly must get it, and then they will agree with us and act accordingly. And unfortunately, that's a model of communication that is empirically invalid. So scientists are superstitious, and when it comes to trying that model over and over again.
You say they're superstitious, they just stick with what they're doing.
Yes.
Which is ironic. And on the other side of the coin,
Which is very unscientific to do,
yes,
that. But it's proven empirically, like 100 times over, it's wrong. It
yes.
doesn't work that way.
Right, right. And I guess, you know, those what you say about the environmental movement, to some degree, the negativity as well, you know, and the way they're presenting the issues, and it's less often that positive visions of what kind of a world we can live in maybe have been presented. But also, what about the other side of the coin? I mean, the disinformation, misinformation, the abuse of information, what we've seen more recently, you've seen it in extreme cases in America and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about their strategies there?
Mm. I'm not sure if it's been conscious. I rather think it's been an issue of learning and learning by trial. So they have been successful in activating these defenses, like the dissonance. For instance, if some scientist or activist comes out, like Leonardo DiCaprio, for instance, at the Oscars, saying that climate change is the most important issue, we need to solve it, and then the misinformation people love to show his yacht, his big house, his private jet, and the same thing with Al Gore. So they can activate the dissonance that people feel inside themselves and then project it on the leading figures. And this way, activating dissonance makes people have a backlash on the attitudes. So we know that if I feel dissonance or I can see dissonance in another, then this will weaken my attitudes over time. So the knowledge component in the attitude loses vis-a-vis the behavior component. Another issue has been the identity issue, which has been very successfully activated, and I think this is very conscious, building on research into memos from think tanks, etc., that if you could call it climate change rather than global warming, and if you could attack the science of being political and coming up with leftist solutions, which is bigger government, more regulations, then you can make it into a political identity issue and you can strengthen the polarization with it. And that's been a very conscious strategy, I think, from parts of the anti-climate movement and the think tanks.
Right, right. So what you're saying is the environmental movement, the climate movement, they need to do better. They need to communicate better. And yeah. What are a few key things? How are they doing? Your book's been out for a couple of years. I guess you've been talking about it. There's this research which you mentioned, which is around as well. How's it going?
I'm quite optimistic. Unfortunately, I don't have the numbers to back these claims up. But it seems to me that there has been a tidal change since 2013 when the IPCC Workgroup 1 came out. I now both observe and hear a much better balance when it comes to the doom versus supported framings. Just give you a short recap of what we know works, because in this literature, which is called the science of science communication, where you study science communication scientifically, I think it's a great field, very important. I think more scientists should learn about it. What we find here is that there are five solutions or strategies that are well documented and evidence-based to work on creating engagement in people. And again, I've simplified this to five main words and solutions. It's making it social, it's supportive framings, it's simple, it's storytelling, and it's signals. So what we know works is that if we can activate social norms that are supportive to solutions, then it will spread like rings in the water. If I believe my neighbor or my friends are going to take climate action, for instance, with electric cars or with solar panels or reducing their food waste or whatever, conserving power, then I will do too. So one study, for instance, from Bob Cialdini, a professor of psychology at Arizona, he took like 4,000 households and then had the first 1,000 households ask them to conserve power because it's sustainable. It's good for the earth, and it's the right thing to do. The second group were instructed to cut their power consumption and save energy because it's good for their children and good for their grandchildren. So think about the future generations. The third group of 1,000 households were told, if they cut their power consumption, they'll save money on their power bill, so you'll end up better for your wallet. And the fourth group were told how much power they used compared to their neighbors. And if you ask most people what would be the most effective condition, is it sustainability, is it then coming generations, is it your wallet, or is it what the neighbors are doing? I guess many would vote for the wallet, but the evidence is very clear when it comes to motivation. It's the neighbors. So each time we run that study, the group that is compared to the behavior of the neighbors comes out with the deepest and the longest decline in power or water use or whatever metric you measure them on. So that shows the power of social norms and just confirms, as we know, that humans are a flock animal. So we're you can see it breaks the distance barrier in the sense that it no longer feels far away from me in time, space, and impact, but suddenly my neighbor is doing something with it. Now it's near, personal, and urgent.
Yes.
The second solution we know works is shifting doom to more supportive frames. And there is some research from psychology that says there is a positivity ratio of 3:1. So to put that into practice, we should have at least 3 supportive messages or framings about the climate change issue on solutions for each 1 climate threat that you bring up. So we should speak about how we can make people's health better as a supportive frame, better safety in our society with avoiding climate change, and also, of course, lots of opportunities for jobs and economic growth. That's the green growth solutions or the green innovations. So health, safety, and innovations are 3 framings that create engagement rather than have people tuning out. And it's not to say that you shouldn't mention the climate threat, but it's the balance it's all about. So 3:1, not 80% or like 80% disaster as used to be the case just 5 to 10 years ago. And the third is to make behavior simpler. And this is to apply behavioral economics, behavioral interventions, where we simplify the choice architecture so that doing the climate-friendly thing becomes a default.
Yes.
For instance, to bring down food waste, for instance, one can reduce the plate or the box size a little. So when people serve themselves, it's more difficult to overserve yourself. And that is proven to bring it down with 20%, the food waste. So it just looks fuller on the smaller plate, but half empty in the bigger, so people take more than they need. So that's just one example, and there are hundreds of green nudges like this, applications of behavioral science. And then we need a better narrative, better storytelling. That's the fourth solution. And we need to explain or envision or imagine how a future society looks that is better than one we have yet, low-emission society. So how do we transform cities to make better lives for their citizens, but lower footprint at the same time? How does that look? And can we tell stories and imagine it in a positive way that makes people want to actually live there? So that's more like I have the dream approach of Martin Luther King rather than the we're all going to hell approach of classical Christian climate communicators. Finally, there's the signals solutions, which has to do with what signals we use, because if people want to keep up their engagement, they need frequent feedback on how well they're doing in their problem solving. They don't need frequent feedback on the ppm levels of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, or the decadal rate of sea level rise, or average global surface temperature change per century. These kind of signals just doesn't work to motivate people. They're too far, too abstract, too invisible. So to make it, the other extreme would be like in Oslo, where we have street signs showing how many people bike here today. And so when you pass that sign, it counts you as well. So it goes from 501 to 502 when you passed. And in that way, you can also compare how many biked here last year, this year, altogether. So we feel that we're making a change when we contribute doing stuff. We could also do that in our bank statements, that they came with a CO2 footprint attached, and you could compare the footprint to last year's consumption or the next, or your friends or your neighbors or whatever. So yes. By making signals feel near personal and relevant to my circle of influence, we can help people keep up the motivation. And this brings me back to your question. Can I see any change? And actually, I do. I think now we are seeing a shift in how climate communications are being rolled out by reflective practitioners. So it's very encouraging. And also the latest poll or survey I saw from the Pew Global who does surveys in the US, it seems that in 2016 and 17, the level of concerned people are now higher again than it was at the height in 2007 when the previous peak was, almost as high as it was in 1990.
Right. Right, very interesting. It's very, very, very useful tools. What I was going to ask, and I'm mindful of the time, just a couple more questions if I might, but in the same way that there are defenses that we all have when we think about, or don't think about, try not to think about climate change, do scientists have defenses as well? When you say to a scientist, well, you know, you realize, of course, that there are better ways of communicating, or this isn't really an effective way of communicating. Do they have some inbuilt defenses as scientists in how they approach this?
Yes, unfortunately. And I think for those who haven't studied like psychology or sociology or social anthropology, it's like falling prey to this enlightenment idea of what humans are, that we are rational information processors and we are truth seekers. And then they make themselves vulnerable to becoming disappointed when humans turn out to be anything else than that rational evidence weighing individual that the science has taught you to believe. Also, I think many scientists might know these things, of course. They are very intelligent people. Yet, it's hard for them to leave their academic role because they are also social animals in the sense that your peer scientists will start to critique you if you come up with storytelling or become too personal. Your training is kind of focused on bringing the personal equation out of all your articles and all your thought to kind of stick with the logic, numbers, and hypothetical deductive method and analytics. And then in order to reach out, you have to let that go. And that makes you vulnerable from a peer review, peer status kind of thing. Right. Suddenly you become this guy who just yes. go and simplify things too much with journalists, or you hang out with the TV guy people, and what you're saying is ridiculous because it's not precise enough on television and all these kind of things. So there's both this internal expectation that humans should conform to the rational decision-maker paradigm, because you do so yourself when you're a scientist, and then the other is the community of scientists, which have their own social rules and not always conducive to getting the message out.
Fascinating. It's very interesting. Not very much time in a very big topic I'm just about to address, but you talk about the science of science communications. I'm just wondering about the science of mass media science communications as such, if such a thing could be said to exist, because what is the role of the mass media? Because, you know, scientists and how they communicate and what they communicate is clearly important, but for a lot of people it's through the mass media. And I wonder here about, you know, the kinds of the fossil fuel industry or people who have an agenda, an economic agenda, tied into particular arguments and so forth.
Well, I don't know where you're based, but I'm sure you remember the Climate Gate debacle the Climate Gate thing, which was really created not by anything substantial, but only by framing effects. And this thing about being aware about framing effects is something that I would hope scientists would have a kind of compulsory course in the science of science communication. Yes. So it's, you see, in the media, it's impossible to not have your message framed in some way. It's the job of the journalist and the job of the desk and the job of the people who find the images to find some framing or perspective on whatever you're saying. If then as a scientist you believe that, oh, my job is just to bring this report out and just to state the fact and the truth to, or the approximation to truth to the journalists, and then it ends there, then you're setting yourself up to be abused by the media. And the media isn't nice. I'm not defending the media in any way. They're lazy and they're, of course, out to sell more than serve any kind of truth or scientific content transmission to individuals. So they will always look for some kind of frame, and if you're not proactively engaged in getting the right frame for your content, then the possibility or the likelihood for failing is pretty high.
Right.
So yes. What I would advise is to for scientists to read, and we saw this example now just recently with a new report that came out of Cicero. I don't know if you know, or several scientists, the one of likelihood of achieving the 1.5 target after all. Have you been following that? It's just a few days ago.
Yeah, vaguely, yes.
Yeah. So they said, well, actually, it's very hard, but it's like a possibility to achieve the 1.5 target after all. And then it was quickly reframed by the antic people as being about, they were wrong. Now they're finally, these climate scientists are admitting that their models have been wrong all the time. So there's no reason to do anything because the models are wrong all the time. Now, and there's a big debate about this in the communication literature, how we balance what's called the uncertainty framings versus the risk framings. So because they came out or were used as an uncertainty, because scientists are experts in uncertainty. We can discuss error bars and error margins and uncertainties up and down. We're very good at it. But what people then in general hear is that, oh, they don't know. Well, they were wrong. Which is, of course, a complete misinterpretation of the uncertainty issue from a scientific point of view. But if we are better in communicating risk, then we can avoid that uncertainty frame, because risk is really uncertainty times impact, and the impacts haven't changed much, so the risk is the same. So what we could say is that the risk mitigation is probably a little bit better now, and being aware of what pros and cons the risk frames has compared to the uncertainty frames could help scientists in communicating better with journalists. Of course, also avoiding the doom frame and starting with the solutions and then coming to the threats a little bit further down.
Right, very good advice. A big topic, and thank you so much, Per, today for taking the time to share the fruit of your insights and research, and thank you for it all, and I wish you the very best of success in the future.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.